The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This week, the remains of a crime scene emerge through the sand near an ancient lake.
I never expected in any dream that I would find the remains of a massacre, or the earliest massacre recorded in history.
And a brain sensor that melts away after use.
In the future, we envision a kind of bioresorbable, bioelectronic medicine, so to speak.
Plus, what happens when domesticated chickens go wild? This is the Nature Podcast for January the 21st, 2016. I'm Adam Levy.
And I'm Kerry Smith. Humans have been carefully domesticating animals for thousands of years. But sometimes their hard work is reversed. Ewan Calloway went to meet the feral chickens of Hawaii.
If you speak to anyone who's visited the island of Kauai, they'll probably mention two things. Number one, the place is gorgeous. White sand beaches that go on forever, 1,000-meter deep ravines, the whole island's a postcard. And number two, there are chickens everywhere, on beaches, in parks, even outside the KFC. Kauai wasn't always full of feral chickens. Eben Gehring, an ecologist at Michigan State University, says that locals blame it on a pair of hurricanes in the 80s and 90s.
The local residents say that the hurricanes blew the chickens all over the island. The destruction those storms wrought on the island was so severe that the grocery stores were closed, the power was out, people were struggling to find clean water and so on. And so it would make sense that at that point in time, a lot of backyard chickens would be left to their own means.
They went to the jungles where they encountered their distant cousins?
Yeah, something like that.
A couple years ago, intrigued by the heritage of the chickens, Gehring traveled to Kauai to gather some of their DNA. He discovered that they're probably hybrids between regular domestic fowl that escaped and Polynesian chickens that have been roaming the jungles of Kauai for hundreds of years. Now he's back on the island to learn more about the feral chickens.
To learn how this diverse gene pool that hybridization has created is being molded by the selective environment in which these animals live.
Or in other words, to figure out what happens when chickens go wild. In order to study them, you first have to catch them. But the chickens can be wary. We drove to a popular grazing spot for the chickens, a grassy outlook near a waterfall.
So this morning we're headed for the Lookout Falls just near Kapaa.
Evolutionary biologist Dominic Wright has a simple method of catching the birds. He ties a piece of string to his big toe and then ties the other end to a spring-loaded net, and he waits. And then,
as long as you don't focus your attention on the chickens, it's not too hard. The problem is, as soon as you, the reason it has to be toe operated, just a piece of string attached to the trigger, as soon as you bend down or focus any of your attention on them, the birds immediately get suspicious and start moving backwards. So we've kind of, in true field biologist style, have settled on this more ad hoc solution, i.e. a piece of string attached to my toe to trigger the device.
After our short drive to the waterfall, Dominic sets up the trap.
I gather this involves a lot of waiting.
Absolutely. The nicest thing with this is it kind of involves waiting in kind of rather beautiful surroundings, so yeah. It's not nearly so bad. The greater our insouciance, the more relaxed the chickens are.
It takes about 15 minutes, but finally, a hen is tempted by the seed. We casually look away, and then Dominic's toe pulls the trigger.
We've activated our little gull trap, and now we're just gently removing the female. We have a little cage for her. We can just pop her in there.
With our bird in hand, we drive back to the lab where the chicken will be sacrificed and its anatomy examined.
So that's a body weight of 1,204 grams. So that's an incredibly heavy female. So that would be much more akin to a domestic size female. Huge in comparison to some of the other birds we've had.
This stout specimen is one of the largest feral chickens we've seen, and size is just one of the many traits that evolution has tweaked in the feral chickens after 30 years on the loose. Their plumage looks more like their wild ancestors, brilliant reds and greens in roosters and drab browns in hens. But the occasional white feather hints at their domestic ancestry. And the researchers have noticed that they often sit on their eggs before they hatch, a behavior that was bred out of domestic chickens to make their eggs easier to collect. For Gehring, these changes offer important lessons in how animals respond to new environments. And besides, he just loves to watch it in action.
Fundamentally, I'm just fascinated with evolution. That's the simplest answer.
That was Eben Gehring at Michigan State University. And before him, Dominic Wright, who's at Linköping University in Sweden.
Ewan Calloway there, who wrote about his visit to Hawaii in a feature. Plenty of chicken pics up there as well.
Coming up in the news chat, researchers are being kept in the dark after a French clinical trial went wrong.
But first, Noah Baker reports on a new way of monitoring the injured brain.
Every year in the US, hundreds of thousands of people are admitted to hospital with traumatic brain injuries. The most severe cases result from things like car crashes or gunshots, and they often require surgery.
Folks who suffer from traumatic brain injuries, when they're admitted to the emergency room, one of the first things that a neurosurgeon will do will be to insert sensors into the intracranial space.
That's John Rogers from the University of Illinois in the United States. The sensors he's talking about measure the pressure and temperature of the intracranial space, the area inside the skull which houses the brain.
Pressure and temperature are critical parameters that dictate, you know, an individual's health. If those parameters fall outside of a very narrow window, then the surgeon needs to take immediate action. Otherwise, you know, one is facing a risk of brain damage.
These sensors are a vital part of medical practice, but the current technology is far from perfect.
The standard device for this type of application, you know, involves hardware that inserts into the intracranial space and then connects to external data acquisition equipment with hardwired connections, and they remain in operation, you know, during that critical risk period for the patient, which might be several days to a couple of weeks as they recover from their injury. The wires are coming out through a suture site, and that interface point represents a nidus for infection, inflammation, and hemorrhage. And then furthermore, you know, because the devices are not needed forever, but just through that critical operational period, they have to be extracted using a surgical procedure, and that procedure opens up the patient to additional risk.
Rogers and his team of engineers and clinicians are trying to find a solution to some of these problems by making a sensor which will simply melt away when its work is done, what researchers call bioresorbable.
So the vision was to create a device platform that could insert into the intracranial space, measure pressure and temperature with the same accuracy and precision of the current clinical gold standards, but build them out of a complete suite of materials that would biodegrade over time, simply dissolve and disappear completely without a trace, thereby eliminating the need for surgical extraction.
That means using materials which are unconventional in electronics. Copper wires just won't cut it.
There are other metals that are electrical conductors at a decent level, relevant for these kinds of applications, that are at the same time biodegradable. So magnesium is one example. It reacts to form magnesium hydroxide, which is biocompatible. In fact, magnesium is a recommended component of a daily diet. So if you look at a multivitamin, it'll have magnesium in it. So we use magnesium.
Roger's team combined magnesium with a host of other body-friendly materials like silicon to build a temperature and pressure sensor. Then they made it wireless. That reduces the risk of infection at the site where the wires exit the skull.
The wireless embodiment involves two subsystems. One of those subsystems is the actual sensor that goes into the intracranial space. The other subsystem provides wireless data communication. that mounts just under the skin of the skull. So it's outside of the intracranial space. Now, the patch in the current embodiment is not 100% bioresorbable. It's about 85% bioresorbable. But because the device, that part of the device, that subsystem is located outside of the intracranial space, there's very little risk to the patient for a small residual amount of non-bioresorbable material just under the skin.
The team can see these sorts of devices being used in other organs and systems for a wide range of other functions.
These same materials could be, you know, configured in different ways to measure other properties of clinical interest. So I think one of the reasons why we're excited is because, you know, we have a technology that I think is addressing a very specific and important known clinical need. But it's a platform, right? So we can imagine different kinds of sensors used in other parts of the body as well. And not just for sensing. It turns out you can do electrical stimulation. You can do thermal therapy. You can do programmed drug release. So in the future, we envision a kind of bioresorbable bioelectronic medicine, so to speak, where the devices are sensing, but they're also intervening in a therapeutic sense, all in a hardware platform that eventually bioresorbs and disappears after the function is no longer needed.
The device has been shown to be effective in rats, but it's yet to be tested in humans.
We think we have a set of materials and a practical manufacturing route. Where we're going now is to demonstrate the technology in larger animal models with more advanced device designs and materials to allow stable operation of the sensor beyond the time frames that we're demonstrating now, just to kind of over-engineer the functionality. And eventually, you know, step through the regulatory framework that's ultimately needed to, you know, use this kind of device in humans. And that's kind of where we're going. This is the early days on that effort, but we don't see any fundamental roadblocks for getting there.
That was John Rogers speaking with Noah Baker. You can find out more about the sensors in the paper at nature.com/nature.
Stay tuned for research into an ancient murder mystery. But before that, it's time for the research highlights with Corey Look.
Since the Industrial Revolution of the 1800s, the oceans have absorbed a lot of the heat from the planet's warming climate. New research shows that the oceans have taken up nearly half of all that heat just in the past two decades. Scientists looked at ocean temperature data dating back to the mid-19th century. They found that most of that heat has built up in the upper layers of the oceans, but more than one-third of the heat was found below 700 meters. That amount is rapidly increasing as the climate warms. The paper was published in the journal Nature Climate Change. Astronomers have spotted the brightest ever supernova. The exploding star is more than 100 times brighter than ordinary supernovae and about twice the brightness of the last record holder. The supernova is low in hydrogen and seems to come from a massive galaxy that is brighter than the Milky Way. The researchers are baffled by how it originated and what is fueling it. They are now using the Hubble Space Telescope to figure out more about the supernova's home galaxy. You can find the study in the journal Science.
Adam, I've got to warn you, this next story is a bit gruesome.
That's okay. I am very brave.
Okay, then, if you're sure. Well, it concerns a brutal case of mass murder, a whole community group by the look of it, men, women and children.
What happened?
They were shot with bows and arrows or hit in the head.
Oh my God, when was this?
Well, it was about 10,000 years ago, and that makes it the earliest known case of violence involving two groups. The researchers are even calling it the earliest case of warfare. The skeletons were found poking out of the ground in a region of Kenya already well known for more ancient human remains. 12 skeletons were still lying in the positions they'd died in, 10 or so more in fragments. Some of them had arrowheads embedded in them, made of a black rock called obsidian, sharpened to a point. Sharmini Bundell has put on her detective hat and picked up the case, ably assisted by Chief Case Investigator Marta Mirazon-Lar, whose team discovered the crime scene at a place called Nataruk, near Lake Turkana. Marta is still near the field site now, hence the wind you'll hear in the background.
So Nataruk today is a barren area of semi-desert, and yet what we find is that 10,000 years ago, it was the edge of a lagoon, very close to the edge of actually Lake Turkana, and it was full of animals and wildlife, which obviously also attracted hunter-gatherers.
And how did you find the site and the human remains?
The site was actually discovered by this young man called Pedro Bea, So Pedro has been working with us since 2009. So the first day of the season, in the field season in 2012, Pedro said, through translators, because we don't speak the same language, he said, I've got bones for you. So we went to this site, and indeed on the surface there were broken human remains. But then I saw the back of the skull of a person that was just eroding from the ground. And I thought, well, either this is just the back of a skull broken, or there's a whole person there. The chance of finding articulated skeletons, it's small. So we were extremely excited when we found the first ones. And it just so happened that the first that we excavated was lying face down. That's why we saw the back of the head. And the head had been smashed in on both sides. And then the second skeleton to come out of the ground was another one found face down, another man lying prone on his stomach. And he had the obsidian bladelet embedded in the skull. So by then we thought, okay, here we have something really special.
And that sounds pretty violent. So they're the kind of injuries that would definitely kill you.
Yes. So the injury suffered by this man crushed both the side and the front of the head inwards, breaking, causing a number of fractures that radiated throughout the skull. And the neck is also broken. So I am sure the second blow killed him.
This unfortunate man was only one of a number of murder victims found at the site. What else did you find when you excavated?
There were 12 skeletons that were still articulated in the ground, some better preserved than others. And of those, 10 had evidence of having died violently. So among these, 4 have injuries that are consistent with projectiles, presumably bows and arrows. Another 4 skeletons have blows to the head. And then there are some individuals that show fractures to the knees, to the hands, to the ribs, all consistent with a pattern of conflict wounds. Among the most unusual finds for me are actually, one was this young lady who was found sitting, and she had her hands crossed between her legs, lying on the feet that were also crossed. They may suggest that she was bound at the time of death, and she was pregnant. So that was actually a moment that we all stopped to think.
With the range of ages and both sexes being present, this sort of looks like a whole community.
Yes, my interpretation is that this was a small community, a foraging party, and that they were surprised by an attack.
Oh, it's pretty brutal, huh?
Yes, actually it is. But that's one of the things. I think that there are cases of serious violence before. There's even a Neanderthal that has lethal injuries to the head. But we don't know if it was a one-to-one situation or if it involved many individuals. I think that what is unique about Nataruk is that it provides conclusive evidence of something that must have been an intergroup conflict. Evidence for that before you have sedentary societies, before you have villages and cemeteries, that is very unique.
Is this mystery solved now, or are there more questions that you want to answer?
Well, I think that the discovery at Nataruk raises a number of questions. So was this a foraging party? Did they have a base camp somewhere? What did the base camp look like? What was it that they had that was worth raiding for? We don't know if they killed everybody. Perhaps others survived or were taken. Even to think, well, where are the sources for obsidian that somebody was exploiting to make these weapons?
So you've got lots of questions for future episodes of CSI Lake Turkana?
Well, part of the work of the archaeologist and the anthropologist is to act like detectives in a crime scene. In the team, we have people who are trained in physical anthropology and osteoarchaeology, which for skeletons are the same skills that forensic scientists have.
I never expected in any dream that I would find the remains of a massacre or the earliest massacre recorded in history. It had never crossed my mind.
That was Marta Mirazon-Lar. Case closed? Not exactly. Excavations continue apace at Lake Turkana, looking for remains from all periods of human prehistory. To find out more about this murder mystery, make sure you head over to our YouTube channel, where there's a video about the finds. That's youtube.com/naturevideochannel.
Time now for our news chat, and Ewan Calloway is back with us. Hi, Ewan.
Hello.
Our first story is regarding a clinical trial which tragically went very wrong in France. What actually happened here?
This was a clinical trial in northern France in the city of Rennes. It was operated by a company called Biotrial, which was doing safety tests for a Portuguese company called Bial. And what happened is that five patients who were taking this drug fell ill quite severely, and one of them died over the weekend. His brain showed signs of necrotic damage and hemorrhaging.
The main story here, though, seems to be what we don't actually know.
Yeah, the company has yet to release a lot of details about this incident, what drug they were testing. They've only said the general class of drugs. How many people received this drug previously, the safety tests that occurred in animals before humans got this drug, the dosage. I mean, you could just go on and on about the questions that are unanswered here.
What would researchers actually be able to do with this information if they had it?
The first thing people want to know is, what was this drug that these people were given? The company has said that the drug inhibited an enzyme called fatty acid amide hydrolase. And what this enzyme does, it's active in the brain, and it's part of what's called our endocannabinoid system, which is kind of a system of neurotransmitters and neural receptors. They're the same ones that cannabis acts on. And the goal of drugs like this is to simulate some of the aspects of cannabis without the negative side effects. Namely, a lot of people have looked at drugging this pathway to treat pain.
So what stages were the clinical trials at?
So this was what is called a phase one trial. It's, as its name implies, the first trial that's done in patients, and it's only done to test for safety of the compound. It's generally done in people who don't have health problems or healthy volunteers who are generally paid for their time.
And do we have any idea what might have caused these off-target effects of this drug?
You mentioned this term off-target effects, and that's something we don't even know. So we know this drug is designed to inhibit this molecule in the endocannabinoid pathway, basically creating more endocannabinoids circulating through the brain. But it's possible, scientists have told me, that this compound is inhibiting or altering other proteins. We really have no idea what these are. In hopes of identifying what even this drug is, some scientists have looked to the patent filings of this company and identified a candidate molecule. As of today, it has not been confirmed, but they're now trying to model what are the potential off-target effects of this compound.
There's always some risk that a clinical trial may have adverse effects like this. Is there any reason, though, to think that this trial could have been operated in a safer way?
I don't think we have enough information to answer that question, honestly. Clinical trial regulations in France are very severe, so you've got to assume that the company did all the due diligence there. They did safety testing in animals. You know, this never would have been approved if regulators had thought it was going to cause these kinds of problems.
So looking forward, do we expect to find out some more information about what happened here?
I think eventually. There was a similar incident in a clinical trial in the UK maybe a decade or so ago, and an official inquiry was launched and, you know, had a public report. But my colleague in France, who's reported on this as well, has said that French investigations tend to be very tight-lipped, so it could be some time before we actually know what's gone on here.
On now to our second story. And a few days ago, the WHO, the World Health Organization, announced that Ebola had been stopped in West Africa. And just a couple of hours after that, a case of a death from Ebola was announced. How did this happen in such short succession?
What was announced? It was the first time that the three Ebola endemic countries, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia, had all effectively stopped transmission, which means it had been 42 days since the last case. What happened, though, was, you know, basically hours later, a young woman in Sierra Leone died of what was confirmed to be Ebola. And the WHO is still investigating what caused this, but the most likely explanation is that she contracted Ebola from somebody who was latently infected. We didn't know this before, but we've now learned that even after somebody survives Ebola, they carry virus in certain areas of their body, in semen, around their eyes, and this virus can potentially infect other people, and it's happened numerous other times.
How big a setback is this?
You know, the WHO, when they announced that an Ebola transmission has stopped across West Africa, they said that this sort of thing was likely. So they were kind of planning for it. They were expecting it. They weren't trying to get people's hopes up and being, you know, very celebratory. It shows that despite more than 11,000 deaths and 20,000 cases, hospitals maybe aren't watching as closely as they should for Ebola relapses. This woman traveled some distance on public transport. She went to hospital and reportedly was sent back with clear Ebola symptoms. So I think, you know, this should be a wake-up call.
Ewan, thank you very much for joining us. As always, you can find all those stories at nature.com/news.
That's all we've got time for this week. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. So drop us an email at podcast@nature.com or tweet us at naturepodcast. Hope to hear from you soon. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Adam Levy.
The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.